Welcome to PostView.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Premier, Inc. Tools and Past Success in Reducing Pressure, Ulcers, and Associated Harms conference call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press the one followed by the four on your telephone. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Wednesday, February the 4th, 2009. I would now like to turn the conference over to Lauren Solis. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, Charlene. I'd like to say good afternoon and welcome to everybody today, and thank you in advance for joining us at, for Tools and Past Success in Reducing Pressure Ulcers and Associated Harm. I have a few quick announcements I'm going to go over real quick before turning the call over to Gina Puglisi. She's Premier's Vice President of the Safety Institute, and she will introduce our speaker today. Following the presentation, the operator will tell you how to ask questions, but you may also submit them during the presentation through the chat feature located on your screen. We'll keep track of what you send and do our best to answer them all during the Q&A session. Whatever we don't have time to answer, we will try to answer offline and post to the website with the presentation within the next couple days. This webcast is being recorded and will be posted on the same website, the Advisor Live homepage at premierinc.com, within 24 hours. The slides are there. And again, we will put Q&A up in the next couple days. Everything is available for download whenever you want. Look for a follow-up email shortly after today's call, and it will provide you with information on how to access all these materials, and it will also include a link to a brief survey about today's program. Your feedback is very important to us, and we'd hope that you'd take a couple minutes to answer those questions. Again, thank you for participating today, and I'm now going to turn the call over to Gina Puglisi. Gina, are you there?
I am. Thank you. Well, we're absolutely delighted to have Jan Fitzgerald with us today, and I have the pleasure of introducing her. Jan is the Director for Quality and Medical Management for the Division of Healthcare Quality at Bay State Medical Center, which is located in Springfield, Massachusetts. And Jan has a Master's of Science in Acute and Critical Care Nursing from the University of Massachusetts in Worcester. And her clinical experience includes her work in critical care, emergency room, and orthopedics. She's responsible for the program development and all the outcome measurement across her medical center, and she also oversees the clinical performance improvement and all the quality regulatory reporting functions. And she coordinates this for a number of state and national initiatives. She's been one of the leaders at Bay State in their successful pay-for-performance projects, and she works very closely with the clinical teams to really assure that there's a streamlined workflow. She's an active national speaker on various topics related to quality and safety. She's published numerous articles, and she's really been the key to Bay State's success in engaging clinicians to incorporate evidence-based interventions in what they do every day and to help refocus the care at Bay State and refocus the culture of the patient care team. And she's going to share with us today some of her successes in reducing pressure ulcers. Jan?
Hi, Gina. Thank you for that great introduction. And I just want to welcome everybody to the call, and thanks for sharing your time with us. Now, just a couple things before I start. You can see that when you look at my name, I am not a certified wound care ostomy nurse. However, I have worked with some great ones, and part of my success around this topic is really being part of an integrated team and a partner with these great people that really have focused on reducing harm and injury to patients. So we'll begin. Lauren, could I have the next slide, please? Yes, a couple objectives, and they came through with your information. We're just going to talk about pressure ulcer classification, talk about some common interventions to prevent hospital-acquired pressure wounds, and from one of the important things that we know around reliability is many of these things can really be prevented, and because of that, we want to make sure that we've got some good, clear, consistent, reliable documentation of what's going on with these patients, not only on admission but throughout the hospitalization, and then really talk about the importance and what that present on admission can mean to your information, what it means if it's there and what it means if it's not there. Next, please. So this is just a quick review. I think many of us know that the scope of the problem. It does happen quite often. It's 1 to 1.7 million pressure ulcers in the United States. The incremental cost can be anywhere between $12,000 and $24,000 per patient. When you look at the number of wounds and you look at the number of extra costs or excess costs, it really does attribute it upwards of $8.5 billion. Length of stay can be increased anywhere between 2 and 5 times, again, depending on the patient and when and how bad the ulcer is. It can also be projected that 53,000 pressure ulcers find that they do ulcer pass through acute care every day. And most of the time, as I said, it's largely preventable. Next, please. One of the things I would just ask you guys to think about or to focus on is this had just recently come through for HCAP. It was a statistical brief number 64, and much to our chagrin, as we, next slide please, Lauren. Much to our chagrin for most of us who have been working on this for a long time, the pressure ulcer rate has increased in the past decade. And when we think about all the work that we've done, the heightened awareness, all the interventions to really stop this from happening, to see that it has gone up really makes us wonder if it's all for naught. But one of the things that we do know is patients have changed a lot. Patients are here longer. They're sicker when they get to us. And many of them are at risk. So no matter what we do to prevent these, they still can happen. And that is one of the rubs with this whole hospital-acquired condition thing that came into effect October 1st is absolutely preventable versus relatively preventable. But when you look back, we do see that increase. One of the things that we look at is it is 53% it's a primary diagnosis and 54% it's a secondary diagnosis. Patients where it's a secondary diagnosis, they're usually their risk of mortality is much higher than if it's a primary diagnosis, and you'll see several bullets down, their risk of dying is 1 in 8 if they have a pressure ulcer as a secondary diagnosis. One of the reasons that CMS really got focused on this is because 72% of patients who acquire these things are covered with Medicare, and it was a pretty strong driver in helping them to solidify the decision to use hospital-acquired pressure wounds with decubitus ulcers. And you see, again, increasing the length of stay as well as the cost per case. Next, please. And as we think about who gets these things, again, from that paper that was just that brief that I just referred to, it talks about the common conditions. This group of common conditions, these top 10, account for about 70% of patients who develop pressure ulcers. So as we think about using objective measure to tell us what a patient's risk is, we should, in the back of our minds, perhaps be thinking about if they have any of these common conditions, they would be also at a risk, although their objective score may not be indicative of their risk. And then the second figure down there talks about diagnosis is varying by age. You see in the younger group, it's typically paralysis, and then as we sunset into our older years or our golden years, you see this more medical conditions that lead to the pressure ulcer being acquired. Next, please. Again, risk of developing a wound can also be determined by where the patient is located. Again, critical care services. We know those patients who are hemodynamically unstable, it's tough to turn and kind of get them positioned and put all those interventions in place that we know can prevent a pressure wound. Again, as we think about objective risk assessment, what their conditions are and where they are, again, can be risk factors as to who's at an additional risk to develop a wound. Next, please. Now, what I want to talk about a little bit today is the pressure ulcer basics. And these are some of the things that we walk through with our physician partners here at Bay State Medical Center. Just one of the things I will say that any nursing employee that comes to us gets a 3-hour session talking about wound care and prevention of pressure ulcers. Our physician partners that come for a long time got no introduction to pressure wounds or wound care, and now what we do is we have a nice 30-minute review that we do with them, and it really is focused on these common things: assessment, documentation, intervention, education, and then some of the things that we've done to make it stick so that we are providing this reliably and we don't have to do a lot of rework at the end. Now, I just want to thank my colleagues here at Bay State Medical Center. They were nice enough to review and to share some of their slides with me, and they, courtesy of the Wounded Hyperbaric team, and some of this consult, some of this information does come from the National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel as well. Next, please. So one of the things we like to make sure people realize is it is an injury to the skin. The skin is an organ, and it can be a direct injury as well as the underlying tissue. Most of the time, it's a result of pressure or pressure in combination with shear or friction. Now, one of the things we like to make sure that our doctors know is if there's no pressure, it typically isn't a pressure wound. So we want to make sure that they're not documenting all that the skin breakdown opening is a pressure ulcer. So we really work with them hard on this. You know, if there's no bony prominence, if there's no pressure, then it's probably not a pressure wound. And there's a number of contributing factors and confounding factors that are associated with these. And as you know, they can be full or partial thickness. Next, please, Warren. Here's some common ulcer locations. And I'm going to use the word pressure ulcer, decubitus, and hospital-acquired pressure wound interchangeably. Depending on your culture and how your hospital refers to them, the terms are really interchangeable. In fact, if you still look at the 3M coding software, they're still calling them decubitus ulcers. So these are common locations for pressure ulcers, and you'll see almost all of them have a bony process or something that really is going to come in contact with a surface that's going to cause compression of the skin and underlying tissue. So those are typically pressure ulcer locations. Next, please. There is a common pressure ulcer staging taxonomy that's out there. It has just been reworked a little bit, and the new things that have been added were unstageable as well as deep tissue injury. We're going to just talk about those in a couple minutes. But let's just briefly and quickly go through the stages, which for many of us are a review. Next, please. A stage, before we do that, when should you stage a pressure ulcer? Well, remember, most patients that come in, there's two things. We not only stage pressure ulcers if they have one, but we do a risk assessment. So at our hospital, any patient that comes in, regardless of what their age is and whether they have a wound or not, gets a pressure, gets an initial assessment of their skin. In that assessment, if they have a pressure wound, that's when the wound is assessed. And we do it every day so we can actually judge whether the wound is improving or it's not. Typically, when you stage the pressure ulcer, whatever the highest stage of the wound is what the wound classification it will be. So if the patient has a 3 and a couple, it moves back and forth between a 3 and a 2, it would be a 3, or a healing 3. So it really is the highest stage when you identify it at the beginning. And once things have started to heal, you really don't want to do downstaging. If it's a stage 3 and now it's healing, it's not a 2. It's a healing stage 3. And some people forget that we don't downstage wounds. What it is what it is. And how you describe it really talks about if it's fresh or if it's healing. And the other thing is deep tissue ulcers really do not heal by replacing missing tissues. Next, please. So one that we all see typically is a stage 1, and it really is that persistent redness that does not blanch. So a patient is lying on their side, and the red spot is gone in really 20 minutes or so. It really isn't a stage 1. They can be persistently red. They can be blue or purple, and depending on the patient's skin tone. And you're going to find some changes based on what it looks like compared to the other parts of the skin. It could be warmer, cooler, firmer, boggy, and painful or itchy. Typically no open areas, and most commonly seen on those bony prominences. And next, please. 2, partial thickness. This is where we've got some blistering for the most part that we'd like to keep intact. They are superficial. There is a little bit of loss, and as it can really look like a blister or an abrasion, and most of the normal, the skin surrounding that area is normal, and it does involve the epidermis and a little bit of the dermis. Thank you. Next. 3, these are the full thickness skin loss, and you know, these are the ones that we all hate to see, because a lot of times this is the beginning of a terrible cascade of things that can happen to patients. Damage or necrosis to the subcutaneous tissue may be able to extend down, but doesn't go through the fascia. Typically, a deep crater can have some undermining and is a full thickness epidermis, and the dermis is lost or missing. And the bed may be subcutaneous fat, although you might see some slough or some necrosis or some granulating tissue in there. Next. And then fours, which are the big whoppers. There's a lot of extensive skin loss, tissue necrosis. There could be damage to the muscle, the bone, supporting structures. The wounds are deep. You can see those bones. They may or may not have exposed tendon sloth or eschar. Many times there's undermining and tunneling. And many a times we think they're fours, but because the base of the wound is covered with eschar or sloth, it's really not the best to be calling them stages four. So they would be actually technically unstageable. And if you've seen these, I've been a nurse for a long time, and in the old days we used to see these, and they're pretty impressive when you see them and people's behinds or their hips or their backs or things like this. And they really can be the sentinel event of the end, as I said, for many people. Next, please. Two new categories that have come forward in the last 24 months is a deep tissue injury, which is really related to wounds that begin in subdural tissues. And typically you see these, think about those patients that come into the hospital that may have spent 3 or 4 days on the bathroom after falling, and they've got those big purple spots and areas on them. You know, they're not pressure wounds yet, but we certainly know within the next 24 to 48 hours they are going to bubble up and become a pressure wound. So that it really is a deep tissue injury, and they can be pretty extensive. And we really want to do as much as we can to prevent these things from expanding or from deteriorating. And then unstageable, as I talked about a little bit, they are typically full-thickness tissue loss with a base that's covered by fluff, which can be any and many colors, or eschar that you really can't tell what the bottom of that wound looks like. So those now are classified as unstageable. Next, please. Now, one of the things that is so key to not only the plan of care, but now that these things are publicly reportable, not only for the hospital-acquired conditions, but also for patient safety indicators, is clear, consistent documentation. What we're looking for is presence of the ulcer on admission or within the first 48 hours, and that really is going to flag not only for the hospital, but for CMS that wound was present on admission. And for us, physician documentation is very key. And we've got some areas, I'm going to show you a couple examples in just a few minutes, where they can actually check off on the computerized H&P or the handwritten H&P, and it'll kind of prompt them to tell us if the patient has a wound or not, and if it's a wound, is it a decubitus ulcer, and that's done at admission. The other thing we do is we have electronic capture of the nursing process. When patients come in, the nursing assessment is a system-generated Braden scale that does the risk assessment, and also in the event that the patient has a wound, the nurse documents against that. And there's a branching logic against about what to do next. So we really are doing as much as we can electronically and reliably in the flow of work, so people don't have to remember to do something. It's right there, and it makes it part of the flow when the patient is actually getting an intake assessment. We, of course, like to document the type and location of the wound if there's one present. Oh, wait a minute, 1 second. Go back, please. Document any improvement, what's being applied. And one of the things that you might want to think about, we have wound care nurses that are housed in our wound care and hyperbaric clinic, however, they come in and they do consults to inpatients in our hospital. Sometimes you have a physician who may have identified a hepatic lesion as a pressure wound, and we'll get a wound care consult. And what we'll do is we'll make sure that the wound care consult is there, and whether or not they discern the patient is the wound is a hepatic lesion or a decubitus ulcer, that the physician actually defers to the experts. So the physician might be calling it a hepatic lesion, the wound care consult people are calling it a pressure wound, or vice versa. So we really have them defer to the wound care consult. We have mid-level nurse practitioner as well as some physicians that do this in concert with our wound care nurses. So when we think about physician documentation really clearly telling us what kind of wound it is, this has really worked well. The thing is we have a multidisciplinary approach so that if somebody identifies a wound, it actually will flag to either the physician or the nurse. And then we do the periodic evaluation. And then one of the things we've put in place prior to any data going externally out of our hospital that's going to drive our patient safety indicators or our hospital-acquired conditions, we make sure that, yes, it was indeed a pressure ulcer and get that documentation whether it was present on admission or not. And that really has helped us drive our numbers down. Reliable data to deliver reliable care. Next, please. Thanks, Warren. And here's an example of our handwritten H&P, and you'll see on admit wound in the corner, it's circled in skin disruption, it's cubitus, and then we ask for the description. Next, please. And here's our computerized physician order entry, and under wounds, and it's in the upper half, it's a skin, no change, pressure, ulcer, or other. And they click on that, and they can actually talk about exactly what it is. And it's one of the mandatory fields that we require of our physicians. So it has worked really well to help capture the data right at the beginning when it's fresh in everybody's mind. Next, please. Okay, so one of the things I just want to talk about now is a little bit of prevention. But before I talk about prevention, I just want to bring to your attention, there was a systematic review that was published in December in JAMA, Dr. Reddy and Gill and Cochran and et al., and they really talked about treatment of pressure ulcers, which was a systematic review. Now, we're going to talk about prevention, but I would just draw your attention to that because there's a couple things that came out in that review which really talked about things such as, you know, support services. We're going to talk about support services support surfaces in a little while. And really, based on their review, there was really no one support service over the other. They talked about support surface with a standardized mattresses and repositioning. They also talked a little bit about nutritional supplements and what their impact was on healing, calcium alginate and other wound dexameter paste and other kind of dressings. So I would really encourage you guys to look at that because it was pretty eye-opening, I think, for a lot of people, and it really does talk about a lot of the things that we've done for wound care, actually maybe more grounded in history and experience and training than actual science. So you might want to just check that out. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about prevention, and then I'm going to talk about what Bay State did to be so successful. Next, please, Lauren. So what we do know is risk is predictable, and they include age, immobility, poor nutrition, sensory problems, circulation problems, dehydration, and such. And the skin can deteriorate in hours. You know, a good example is that person who is on the floor in the bathroom for a couple days comes in, and within 24 to 48 hours, they're going to have a wound. Other good examples are patients that are in the operating room where we don't have a pressure release surface on the operating room table. They might be flat in the same position for 6 to 12 hours. They come up to the postoperative area, and within 24 hours, they have a pressure ulcer. So you really need to be thinking about these things. It is an organ, and it can go fast, and once it starts to go, it's tough to kind of reel it back in. Wet skin is more vulnerable than dry skin, although dry skin is a risk factor as well. And with the winter and the focus on hand hygiene, we all know a lot of staff that suffer skin issues because of dry skin. Continuous pressure, especially over those prominences, can induce risk, and pressure-relieving surfaces may help. And again, that treatment article is pretty interesting. Next, please. One of the things that has come to the forefront with the 5 million lives was the application of the decubitus ulcer hospital-acquired pressure ulcer prevention bundle, as you know, a group of interventions that should be all applied at the same time, reliably, consistently, that really result in a decrease in this event. And they actually talk specifically, and we've kind of were very pleased when we saw this bundle come out that we were doing all of these things. So it's a reaffirmation that we were on the right track with our reduction program. So looking at assessments and daily assessments, assessment on admission, and then daily assessments thereafter, which includes that skin assessment, inspection, managed moisture, optimized fluids and nutrition, and then minimize pressure when you can. Next, please. A couple other things that we want to think about is keeping that skin clean and dry, personal hygiene, using the right temperature of water, reducing irritants, especially after incontinence, keeps our linens clean and dry and wrinkle-free. If you have braces on patients, make sure that the underneath the skin is that the for example the TEDs are curled or wrinkled, that there's a padding on these things. You know, we had a little run of patients that we had our TEDs on, and when they put on the compression boots, they weren't so good at taking those TEDs off to check the skin, so we had a heel ulcer develop. It was we were mortified that this would happen, and right off the bat put a couple interventions in place to stop that from happening. But we also know that cannulas and oxygen masks and other tubes can cause breakdown as well, pressure breakdown as well. We want to keep the environment well hydrated and prevent dryness if we can, and then document everything that we do. Next, please. Nutrition, key. You know, I think as patients come to us and they're sicker and sicker and their nutritional conditioning seems to be going not to be what it was, really is an area that we can't neglect when we're thinking about who's at risk. Albumin and prealbumin, of course, are so key in wound healing and really can help us identify who's going to have a lot of difficulty. Hemoglobin and hematocrit to carry the nutrients as well. Want to make sure that they've got a good protein intake as well as fluids and calories. And then nutritional supplements, although, again, I would urge you to look at that paper by Dr. Reddy to direct you in selection around these things. And really looking at patients who have low body weight with unintentional weight loss. They are really at risk. And then signs malnutrition. Next, please. Incontinence. Now, this is a cyclic thing. We really want to make sure that we're doing as much as we can for bowel and bladder training. And for a long time, I think we saw indwelling urinary catheters as innocuous, and now we know that is not the case. So we want to make sure that we're using them cautiously. There are alternatives to these things, pads and briefs, as well as Texas catheters and female urinals and the such. But in some cases, we absolutely need these things. So we want to make sure that if we're using them, we're putting them in correctly, minimizing their use, and making sure we can get them out as quickly as we can. One of the ways that a lot of hospitals have really reduced their urinary catheter use is institution of the hourly rounding program, where patients are checked every hour. So in the event that something happens, it would the exposure time to urine or to stool would be less than an hour. So it has really helped. Topical barriers are key to protect that skin, and then avoiding plastic pads on low air loss. Next, please. Then other things. So when I started as a baby nurse 30 years ago, one of the things we were told to do is, oh, if it's red, you massage it. Now we know that that really isn't the thing to do. So we need to keep that in mind, although there are some patients who still come in who want their back rubs. But if they don't have red spots, I guess we could do that if we have the time. Avoid shear and friction. Really does decrease the blood supply to the skin. Use positioning as much as you can. And if the patient is self-positioned, we really do encourage that to happen. One, the patient typically may be more comfortable, and they are more inclined to move more frequently. We want to make sure we're using heel protectors and keeping those heels off the bed and the such. And then repositioning. We do, at our hospital, reposition every couple of hours if the patient can't. So we do that odds and evens. I'm going to talk about that in a little while. And then making sure that that we have those overlays in where we can, and encouraging people to move and to be up out of bed. Next, please. Head of the bed. Now, that's something else that has come up. You know, there was a lot of discussion with the ventilator care bundles. You had to keep those heads of beds up 35 to 45 degrees. And we had a little reticence on our skincare team here because 45 was too high. But again, that review that came out said really there was no difference between 30 degrees and 45 degrees as far as the shear and the pressure on the skin. So for most patients, especially if they're ventilated higher, might be a little bit better. But again, to keep that high, to keep them well positioned and really not on their back all the time, bedside. And close the heels as we can, and then avoid that hyperextension, and then check for splint injuries if the patient has a splint on. Next, please. Now, one of the things we're going to talk about is support services, and there was also a review that was done in the Journal of Wound and Ostomy Continence Nurses, and it was done by Krappel, and it really talks about repositioning patients every 4 hours in conjunction with the use of a pressure-releasing service may be as effective as repositioning every 2 hours for preventing pressure ulcers. So when you think about that, that really is a big change in a lot of practices. For a long time, we were repositioning patients every 2 hours. In my hospital, every bed is a pressure relief bed, and we continue to move patients every 2 hours. So a little bit more research needs to be done on this, but it really doesn't... that changing every 2 hours versus every 4 hours on a pressure release surface really doesn't convey any benefit based on this review. So again, a little bit more research needs to be done, but something to be thinking about as you build your skin care and prevention algorithms. There are a couple categories, static overlays and mattress, which are foam, air, and gel, which I think... a lot of hospitals are using air relief, pressure relief with the air, alternating pressure and air flotation, and then air fluided patients. Next. And then support services in the chair, and many of us have seen this, and the bottom line is these are for patients who are sitting in the chair for a long time. And part of putting the pressure relief device in is making sure that the patient can do repositioning and a readjustment every 15 minutes. And also the thing that I think many of us forget is if the patient is chair bound, make sure that they can move the back of the chair as well to really give them some more options on where the pressure points are going to be. Next, please. So let me just tell you about our success and what we've been doing here. We are a 660-bed tertiary care referral center, and you can see all this stuff. We're pretty busy. We have a lot of physicians, which was part of our issue because it's tough to get 1,200 physicians to do one thing the same way all the time. And one of the things that happened is we actually have a hospitalist program, so that has really helped us capture a lot of this information. Next, please. Just a couple. We've been very fortunate this year. We've done pretty well, and we're continuing to focus on where we've been, because what it does is it sets the bar very high, and you have to work harder to stay there than you do have to get there sometimes. Next, please. So when we first started in 1995, our rate was 20%. The national rate was 10. It was a big wake-up call for us, and what it enabled us to do is to get support and money and manpower from the senior leadership. And we were committed to improve, and we charted a team, and we developed our plan, and we were off and running. But just so you know, this is still an ongoing project and an ongoing focus, and it was actually revitalized with the October 1st change in the Deficit Reduction Act. Next, please. So we wanted to reduce our goal, our rate, by 50%, and then we wanted to focus on preventing the wounds and providing evidence-based care to prevent the hospital-acquired pressure wounds, and then provide high-quality evidence-based care to treat our wounds. Next, please. So right off the bat, what we did is we were able to purchase some state-of-the-art beds. They were Zone Airs from Hillrom, and they all have pressure relief and reduction capabilities. And these were on all nursing units. We had a complete exchange. It took about a month, and it really was tremendous because it really allowed us to provide these interventions for every patient, regardless of where they were and why they were here. We also reviewed the literature and customized the skin protocols based on the ARC guidelines, and we then translated those into clinical protocols. We also launched Skin Resource Committee, where every unit had representation, and this person was a volunteer, somebody who was interested in skin and moving forward and help reduce these preventable events. And they were really responsible. I was the skincare resource on my unit when I started, and we are responsible for monitoring, educating, and really disseminating the information, good, bad, and the ugly. And it really is a nice way. Fortunately for us, we haven't had a lot of change in this group. It's a pretty group that's well entrenched and are really viewed as either formal or informal leaders on their unit. So it really has helped us keep this out in front of everybody. Next, please. So we adopted our Braden risk score, and we do it on admission. As I said, it's a system-generated order with the computer, so it's done on admission. You have to do it or it doesn't go away, and then it's done every 24 hours. The other thing we did is we trained everybody and anybody who would come into contact with the patient, our technical associates, PT, dietary, that if they saw redness, that they needed to make sure that they told the nurse immediately so that the nurse could intervene, do the assessment, and make sure that those interventions were there. We have a every two-hour model here on most of our units. Some units we have an hour model, but for the most part we're turning and giving fluids every 2 hours and checking for incontinence. On the odd side of the hall and on the odd hour, the odd side is turned, and on the even hour, the even side is turned. We have access to our wound care nurses. As I said, they are housed in the wound care clinic, but they do spend the afternoon doing wound care consults as well as working with the nurses around wound prevention and wound treatment. A lot of interdisciplinary education programs. These are ongoing throughout the year. We have explicit criteria where we have specialty beds ordering, so a nurse just can't order a specialty bed based on what she thinks they should have. It's pretty explicit. And we've had standardization of our wound care products through our value analysis committee. And we do our prevalence studies. We do them quarterly, and on some units they're done every day, depending on the unit and the severity of illness for the patient. And very important is any hospital-acquired pressure wound undergoes a mini-root-cause analysis. And what we're looking for there is, did we do something or didn't do something that we should have done? And that's very compelling for our staff as well as a learning experience. And it really has helped keep this high on the priority list. Next, please. Just so you know, CMS changed the process. As we know, these are hospital-acquired conditions that are reasonably preventable versus absolutely preventable, we're looking pressure ulcers that were present on admission still qualify for the higher reimbursement as long as it's recorded within 2 days. So that means the patient had it, so any severity of illness or charges occurred to the care are not going to be impacted versus one that occurs in your hospital. Patient develops a hospital-acquired pressure wound, charges that were attributed to that care, if it puts the patient in a higher DRG, are not going to be paid. And the National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel has really been key in working with this and making sure that it's reasonable and that it really makes sense as they work on the revisions around the ICD-9 coding and reimbursement model. Next, please. So education, we educate our physicians, looking at staging, use of wound care, and we always ask them to defer to the expert. If they're going to get a counsel, defer to the expert. And nursing is focusing on the details, not only on the assessment, but on the prevention and treatment. And we have a good, structured, organized approach, and we really do update our content regularly based on what comes out of NDNQI and the advisory panel. Next, please. Now, a couple key things. We're fortunate we have a computerized physician order entry electronic medical record here. We are actually able to automate a lot of these processes. The grading scale comes up. It won't go away unless you do it. The score requires a response, so you're either going to invoke the reduction and prevention guidelines or you're going to put a treatment plan in. And based on the patient's risk or treatment plan, it's going to generate an automatic consult for skin care, and it comes up every day. So every day, the nurse needs to do her inspection and post her assessment. So that works very, very well for us. So you know if you've got to remember to do it, you're going to forget. So it's automatic. This is a version of the skin wound, and you'll see here it talks about when to get a therapeutic bed, how to get a therapeutic bed, when to notify, and the such. It works very, very well. Next, please. Sandy and I talked a little bit about that turning schedule and the H&P form. The other thing with the computer, the physician can actually import the actual wound assessment if he or she feels so. And one of the other things we've done, you know, it makes a lot of sense to buy those beds with the pressure relief and the heel relief, but, you know, if they're not plugged in and turned on, they're not going to help you. So part of change of shift is every bed plugged in, and the heel activation and the pressure relief on is one of the things that are checked, and they actually have to document that. We have the decision tree for special care beds, and we did purchase some really nice pressure relief pads for our long cases in the operating room. So really standardizing. So if you're having this kind of procedure in the major operating room, you're getting this kind of pressure relief. So again, standardization. A couple, just a screenshot of our wound care and skin protocols, as well as our decision tree for therapeutic beds as part of standardization. Next, please. Program skin education. We, RNs, technical associates, physicians, are skin-based champions. We do training programs, the assessment, prevention, assessment, and documentation. We also spend a day with the wound care nurse. Staff development is key. They have everybody attend skin integrity lecture and orientation, and we have annual online competencies that are done as part of our process. We also have an annual wound care conference, and our one of the nice carrots is our unit-based representatives can actually attend this nice conference for free, get a great lunch, learn some good stuff, and get CEUs. So
they
really
can't force you to sit down. I mean,
pardon me? What? Next, please. Monitoring. We do daily review in some units, typically the high-risk areas, so that's the critical care areas. The skin champions are out there doing as much as they can to make sure the right things are in place. But other than that, we do a prevalence study on a quarterly. The unit champions do kind of coordinate the survey. It's done one day in a four-hour block. The results come here. We do the analysis in healthcare quality, and then it's widely disseminated to anybody and everybody. Every unit has their indicators posted and their hospital-acquired pressure wounds, as well as prevention measures, compliance is posted. Next, please. Massachusetts has got a publicly reported website for, as you can see, pressure wounds, and we're fortunate, yellow or orange is Bay State and against the peer group. So all our work has really paid off because we've got some really great results, and we've actually been able to hold the gains around this. Next, please. Where we stand now, you see the top one is our assessment completion on the Braden scale and our volume on the left and our percent completion on the right, and then our run chart on where we are for hospital-acquired wounds. And you see we've had some really nice flattening and some really low rates. Unfortunately, the last quarter, we had a little blip. We had 5 wounds, and they were variably staged, but they did come up. So unfortunately, really gives us some additional focus to really kind of drill on those and keep kind of see what happened, where did we fail, and can we learn from that blip. Next. So all I can say is you need to stay vigilant, and that's kind of what we do. Now, as I said earlier, any chart that's flagged during coding that looks like it's a hospital-acquired pressure wound stops. The coding process stops, and we have a clinical review. Myself or one of the nurses that works for me look at the record, and we're looking for the appropriate documentation and validating that, yes, this is a pressure ulcer and it happened in the hospital, or no, it's not a pressure ulcer, or it was a pressure ulcer but it was present on admission. So we really want to make sure that that data is clean. So we look at 100% of those records. If it is a wound that happened in the hospital, we send it off to the nursing peer review committee to really say, what did we miss? Was it preventable, and how can we learn from this? And that is actually their responsibility to do the root cause analysis and tell us what they found. And it really helps keep everybody engaged and focused on this. And they're required to tell us what their next steps are around this. Next, please. Hospital-acquired conditions. I've referred to this a couple times, and the key here is making sure that you have it well demarcated, what was present on admission and what was not present on admission. Next. Here's our data, and I just want to tell you, the red circle, the one to the right just talks about cases that have pressure ulcers documented, and that would be 58. So when you apply the present on admission flag, you see that number goes from 58 to 7. And those are all kinds, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They don't discern. So it's so key to really make sure that your coders are working with your clinicians to make sure they're getting that present on admission correctly. Attention to the details, not only with screening and intervention, but attention to the details around your documentation and coding is really going to help you and get you some good, accurate numbers. Next, please. So, that being said, we have a few minutes, and I guess we'll just open it up for questions. Gina.
Thank you.
Gina?
Yes, I'm here. I was on mute. Thank you so much. That was really a wonderful presentation. This concludes our presentation, and we want to invite everyone listening to ask questions or to comment on what we have discussed. Charlene, would you please instruct our participants as to how to register a question to ask today?
Sure, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. If you are using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before entering your request. One moment, please, for the first question.
Let me just bring a question that's been added to our chat questions, and that is, Jan, if you could talk about how you educate the physicians on documenting present on admission. What process do you use?
We do a couple things. When our house officers come to us, we actually give them a little blurb on documentation generally, and we specifically now talk about conditions and how clearly they have to be documented. So that's a one-on-one. We do that in noon conference. We do that in morning report. We do that at grand rounds. So for the house officers, that's how we do it. Now, for our attending physicians, we go quarterly. We are invited to do grand rounds in surgery or anesthesia, and part of that is the quality and safety agenda. So what we do is we actually talk about, every time we talk about hospital-acquired conditions, present on admission, so they know what they are and that they potentially are going to get a call from myself. We stand up there with giant red X's on us, myself or Gina or Marge, about validating that the data is real. Now, the best way to teach them is that one-on-one. So they know they possibly can expect a call, and they actually expect a call, and they're pretty receptive. So we just go through what we see, what it looks like, and what they need to tell us or what they need to amend in the discharge summary. So it's mailings, letters, grand rounds, noon conferences, our inter-hospital communications, as well as one-on-one and working with our house officers. You know, the way we look at it, for a long time, this was kind of a hidden thing, but, you know, the horse is out of the barn. The hospitals need to be able to know what their rate is. The clinicians need to know what's going on and what can they do to make sure that that information is reliable and accurate. And that's really how we've been able to do it. So, you know, we've been working on this for about 2.5-3 years. We started with the patient safety indicators before this hospital-acquired condition ever came up. So we've kind of got them pretty well trained now. We just need to continue to tweak our electronic tools as we migrate to the complete electronic medical record. So it really has worked out pretty well. And a lot of times they're happy to work with us because they don't appreciate, for whatever reason, what the power of the pen can do.
Great. And Charlene, could we have our first caller?
Sure. Our first question comes from the line of Roberta Upham with Memorial Regional Hospital. Please proceed with your question.
My question is, do you have a turning team, or is it the nurse and the aide? How do you accomplish this? We have a very heavy population of elderly being in South Florida, most of which need to be turned. We at our hospital have a lot of indigent patients whose skin isn't good and who cannot always turn very well. So our turning is very heavy. How do you manage this?
We don't have a turning team per se, but what we do have in many of our units that are heavy surgical medical patients that have got almost the population that you described, we have orderlies that will actually work together as a team. So the orderly from Springfield 1 will bond with the orderly from Springfield 2, and they'll go right down the row on Springfield 1 on the odds, and then they'll go up to Springfield 2 and do the odds, and then they'll go back to Springfield 1 and do the evens, and then they'll go back to Springfield 2 and do the evens. So they work together, and they typically are orderlies, young, strong men with pretty good backs right now, but they're not here all the time. But we make sure that our TAs work in together. The nurses, if they're working on a team, may be part of the turning team, but typically it's the nursing assistants or our technical associates who are going to be turning. They never work in solo. They always work as a team, and if they think they need help, we have access to it. We have some ceiling-mounted lifts and as such, so they have tools that they can do. We have sliders and turning boards and things like that. So we don't have a dedicated team, but we do have focus on the turning, and that's why the standardization of the scheduling has really made a difference. And people know what time they're due to do this, which is the other thing. It's not a surprise. Okay, we're doing the odd turn now.
Thank you.
Thank you. There was another question that came in and a discussion on it in the chatting, and that was whether or not a written consult is needed to get wound care. And it seems, you know, that in the discussions back and forth that it seems like it's about 50-50, needing a consult or not needing a consult. What is it that has happened at your facility, Jan?
Well, at our facility, any nurse can call for a wound care consult, and they'll come from the clinic into the inpatient. If the patient requires ongoing nursing wound care consult, the nursing person will continue. There is no, I don't need an order to do that. I can use my nursing judgment and get the wound care people, the wound care nurses up there. If the patient needs more extensive therapy, i.e. a debridement or something else, then they'll actually get the wound care physician involved. Then it's a physician-to-physician consult, so that would be because they need to do the Part B. So we don't need an order, per se, for a wound care consult. The nurse can generate her own. However, sometimes they do get an order for a consult, so it's variable. But it's not a barrier to us. We really have said, you know what, if the patient has so many risk factors and we're having a trouble deciding what to do with the wound risk or the wound intervention, then we'll just get the consult.
Great. Charlene, can we have our next caller question, please?
Yes, our next question comes from the line of Barbara Fulmer with Eisenhower Hospital. Please proceed.
Hello. I'd like to ask a question to clarify when the documentation for present on admission by the physician needs to be done. Some interpret that documentation actually needs to be done prior to admission. So I wondered, you had presented that within 2 days of admission. And I wondered, is there any written information from CMS regarding the time requirement?
Well, first, you have to think about present on admission. It might take you the whole admission to figure out whether something was present on admission or not. But as long as you can, in the course of the hospitalization, demonstrate that it was present on admission, then you're good. Now, let me just tell you what we do. I don't care whether it's 1 day, 2 days, or 3 days. All I want to know from my doctors is, was that wound present on admission or not? So for us at Bay State, if it's present on admission, write that it was present on admission. If it's unclear, then write that it was unclear. That isn't held against you. The new stuff that's come out from CMS and the National Advisory is they're looking at those three, greater than two, within the first 48 hours is going to get you equal to present on admission. We know that that's too much for people to think about. So we really focus them on, was it there when the patient came to us or not? And whether it was present before they got here or not, what we want to know is when that patient became an inpatient at Bay State Medical Center, was that wound there or not? And using that standpoint, we've actually done, as you can see, a very, very good job. But it's shaky because there are those patients, grandma who's in the bathroom for 3 days, you know, within 24 hours she's going to have a stage 2 or a stage 3. That was present on admission. So that's what they're talking about when they talk about the first 48 hours. Okay, does that help?
Uh-huh.
Okay, great.
Lauren, do we have time for one more question?
Actually, we started about 5 minutes late, so I think we've got about five more minutes.
Okay, so the next question, Charlene?
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of William Gardner with IPRO. Please proceed. William Gardner with IPRO, your line is open.
I'm sorry, I was on mute. Hi, Jan. I did have a question along the same lines about the documentation within 2 days. I was familiar with the regulation as being any time during admission, but I'd like your explanation of holding the physicians accountable for within those 2 days so that at least you get treatment started, you get it identified, and then it's in the record and it's secure then, so that at least you've got a decision point to go forward from.
Yeah, and it, you know, one of the things we know, people have to remember, the further it gets from admission, the least, the less likely they are to remember certain things. So we really do drive them to capture it on admission. One, it's easy to capture it on admission, and then it's done, they don't have to worry about it.
Yep.
And that really... Now remember, we fix it at the back end, though. So here's a perfect example. The nurse documents in her assessment the patient's got a stage 3 decubitus from the nursing home. Physician doesn't look at the patient's behind, so he doesn't know. 3 days later, he or she is writing, oh, stage 3 wound. But we can look in the nursing assessment and say, hey, that was there on admission. So we can then work with our physician to say, hey, look it, this was present on admission. You don't write it until day 3. That means it looks like it happened at the hospital on day 3. So we are able to get them to pull in the wound assessment from the admission into discharge summary or into H&P or daily progress notes so that it's clearly identified that the patient came to us with this. So it works really, really well. So we, you know, the catching it on the front end and kind of safety netting it on the back end has really helped. And I would encourage any hospital that is concerned or doing work around hospital-acquired conditions to make sure that your coding department does not finalize those records until a clinician looks at it. Because you know what? There is no price for a quality reputation. These numbers are going to be publicly reported, and once they're out of the hospital, they are out in the hospital for the world to see and to use. So you want to make sure that you make sure that that data is reliable and valid before it leaves you.
Thank you very much.
Next question.
Our next question comes from the line of Erin Kelly with Wright State Physicians. Please proceed.
Hi, Jan. I have two questions. Do the CMS guidelines allow for APNs to document present on admission?
Well, interestingly enough, all the other CMS things, it can be a mid-level NP nurse practitioner, advanced practice nurse, or a physician. So it can be a mid-level. So if you have an advanced practice nurse, you're golden.
Okay. And then secondly, when you referred to the coding review, is that all retrospective or concurrent?
Well, a lot of times you're not going to know what the prospective coding is going to be till the patient has been discharged. So what we do is it's retrospective, but it's not finalized.
Okay.
What we've done is in our 3M coding software, if any of those patient safety indicator codes or hospital-acquired condition codes come up, the coder who's got it stops coding the record and it goes to clinical review, and we look at it and work with our coding team to make sure that it is what it is. You know, remember the DRG, ICD-9, all that stuff was a payment system. It wasn't a system that really is clinically reflective of what we do to, for, and why for patients. So you want to make sure that you're catching them before they go out.
Thank you.
Do we have any more questions, Charlene?
Yes, our next question comes from the line of Nancy Connolly with RCM and D. Please proceed.
Hi, Jan. Thank you. This has been a wonderful presentation. And I just wanted to know if you have any references for photography, especially as far as long-term care goes, whether or not, A, they should be done, and B, guidelines for, I'm sure out there somewhere there are published guidelines for type of photography, distance, using a ruler, and other parameters. Do you have any references for that?
I don't have it. I personally don't have any references. I could certainly check with our wound care team because I know they, not our wound care team, our wound care and hyperbaric clinic uses photography, and I'm sure they have some standards. We can certainly send those along, and they have okay. Put the ruler in so you can make sure that you can size it. They have the grids with the special camera, and they have a recommended re-photographing increments and things like that. I tell you, we in our hospital we don't use photographs, although sometimes I think we should because it certainly does. One picture is worth a thousand words, as we all know, especially in these things. They can be so compelling when you see some of them. We do use photographs in the wound care and hyperbaric, and usually it's for improvement and progression of healing so that the patient can actually see, because these take a long time to heal, a lot of these things, so the patient can actually see the improvement. But I don't have anything. I can certainly pull theirs and send it along. If that's something that you guys would like to see, I can do that.
That would be great. Thank you.
The other thing I would actually the wound care and ostomy nurse association, I'm sure, has recommendations around this as well, as may be also the pressure ulcer advisory panel. But that's a great question. That's a great question. It's amazing we don't, with this digital age, it's amazing we don't do more pictures.
Lauren, I think we're at the end of our time.
Yep, I think so. We've been doing it an hour, Jan, and I just want to thank you. I think that there's a lot of unanswered questions, and I posted a moment ago on the chat that I'll get with Jan to try to get answers to what we didn't get to, and then I will post those on the website with whatever information is sent to me, as well as an audio file and the presentation from today. So in the next, I'd say, 24 to 48 hours, there should be a wealth of information there for you to download.
Sorry, you put that article up as well, Dr. Reddy's article from JAMA. Would you put that up there as well?
Was it in the presentation?
No, but Gina, I think you have the reference.
Yeah, we can add the reference.
We'll get it.
Yeah, we'll get the reference. We can't post the article because it's in a peer-reviewed journal and it's copyrighted, but we can certainly post the references to the two articles that you mentioned, Jan.
Yep, that'll be great. Excellent.
And okay,
thanks,
well,
buddy, for your time.
Yes. Thanks. Thank you, everybody. And again, this will bring us to the end of our call tomorrow, or actually in a few moments here. I'll send you an email with instructions on how to access all of this information. Again, we've got about a 5-question survey on there. We'd really appreciate your input and to hear maybe some ideas of what you have in mind for future Advisor Live. Visit our Advisor Live webpage a lot, frequently. We update it constantly, and we're doing 2 sessions a month, so I think we'll have a lot out there for everyone. Jan, thanks again. Have a great vacation. Gina, thank you for your help.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation. We ask that you please disconnect your line.